interrupt in the chat if you have a problem. If you can't hear me, although we usually don't have problems like that. And so I guess the first thing I want to say is that about the importance of a course like this and studying the subject of Lincoln. And it was stated in one of the articles that I put on the reading list by Donald Livingston, and where he said that the whole Lincoln myth, or Lincoln mythology, as I call it, is the founding myth of American nationalism. And American nationalism is the reigning political and economic system of today. And there's a long history of that. I've written several books about it. And basically what American nationalism started out as is not in any way the same as patriotism. It's nationalism. Nationalism is very closely linked to imperialism, actually. But at the beginning of the American Republic, the nationalists in politics wanted essentially, after fighting a revolution against the British Empire, they wanted to create essentially a carbon copy of the British Empire, but the American version. And their opponents were always the Jeffersonians, who were advocates of decentralized government, limited constitutional government, free trade, laissez-faire economics, more or less, whereas the Hamiltonians or the nationalists were in favor of highly centralized government, with the states essentially just puppets of the king, of the executive branch. On economics, they were in favor of corporate welfare, as we would call it today. They called it in those days internal improvement subsidies. They were in favor of high protectionist tariffs, mostly to protect northern manufacturers from international competition. And most importantly, they were in favor of a central bank run by politicians that would finance various types of corporate welfare and would finance cheap credit to politically connected businesses. That was the British mercantilist system, and they wanted to bring it to America. And there was a long struggle about this. I write about it in my book, Hamilton's Curse. It's not about Lincoln, but it's about Hamilton and his political successors, of which Lincoln was one. And this curse, as I call it, finally came into reality during the American Civil War, so-called, and during the Lincoln regime. And so it's really based on the anti-American idea of mimicking the British Empire, not a constitutional republic, but an empire with a highly centralized government, if not a king, a very, very powerful executive branch at the expense of a weak Congress and a weak court, and of course, essentially non-existent states' rights or federalism. That's American nationalism. And American nationalism was always, always linked to economic nationalism, protectionism, central banking, corporate welfare, and also a big public debt. A big public debt that would tie the owners of the debt, in the very least, to the government, because they would always vote for higher taxes to make sure there was money in the treasury to pay off their bonds, their government bonds. And so that's American nationalism. And it's an ugly picture. It's based on greed. It's based on rent-seeking. It's based on the anti-American idea of a highly centralized monopoly government. It's based on unlimited government, rent-seeking, run amok. Therefore, some sort of nice, pleasant-sounding excuse has to be given for it. You can't be a politician. You can't go out in politics and sell your political system if it's based on bribery and corruption and mercantilism and corporate welfare and all these things. You have to create some sort of grandiose myth, and that's where the Lincoln myth comes into play. One of the books I recommended a few minutes ago on the chat is this one. I'll hold it up a bit. The Legacy of the Civil War by Robert Penn Warren. Robert Penn Warren was the Pulitzer Prize-winning a novelist who wrote the famous novel All the King's Men and 19 other novels. But in 1960, the Smithsonian invited Robert Penn Warren to write down his thoughts on the legacy of the Civil War, and that's what he did, the legacy of the Civil War. One of the parts of the legacy that he pinpointed is that the myth that came about after the Civil War was over, the myth, the Lincoln myth, created what he calls a treasury of virtue. The northern states, which is to say the Republican Party, essentially was said to have saved the Union and freed the slaves. And so based on all that virtue, all that stored up virtue, Robert Penn Warren wrote, that virtually anything the U.S. government would do, especially under Republican administrations in the 19th century and early 20th century, anything they would do is by definition virtuous because it is the American government doing it. And that requires forgetting a lot of history, Robert Penn Warren wrote. You have to forget a lot of the truths of history, and especially the truths about Lincoln. And so that's one of the things I hope to do in this course, is to go over the historical record, among other things, and pursue the truth about the founding myth of American nationalism, which really is much of a myth. Now, not everything you read, of course, about Lincoln in the mainstream press and mainstream books is a myth, but a lot of it is. The essential parts of it are. And they're always held up to promote bigger government. On the left, you have President Obama, just not too long ago, in his first inaugural address, proposing war in Iran and Syria, and he quoted the Gettysburg Address. Several years ago, Newt Gingrich, the Republican, proposed war in Iran, Syria, Lebanon, North Korea, and a few other countries. He quoted Abe Lincoln again. Both political parties have played this game for over 100 years of first deifying Abe Lincoln after his death, and then attaching their agenda, whatever their agenda is, to the deification of Abe Lincoln, because, as I said, it is the founding myth of American nationalism. And it's used mostly by the Republican Party, of course, since Lincoln was a Republican, but also by the Democrats, as I said, in Lincoln's first in Obama's first inaugural address. And so to get started really on tonight's lecture, I broke it up, as you can see on the syllabus, into these different sections, different topics. The first topic is Lincoln, race, and slavery. And then we'll talk about Lincoln and the Constitution, the warfare state, and economic policy, and then his legacy to the very last class. But another book I would recommend, I didn't write it down in the chat book, is Forced into Glory, subtitle is Abraham Lincoln's White Dream by Lerone Bennett Jr. Lerone Bennett Jr. was the managing editor of Ebony Magazine for several decades, and he wrote this very scathing critique of Abe Lincoln, Forced into Glory, I believe in the year 2000 it was published, and I recommend it. And as a distinguished African-American writer, Mr. Bennett is incensed that Abe Lincoln has been made into such a hero among black people, among the African-Americans in the United States, because he was never an abolitionist, for one thing. And for another thing, he was as much a white supremacist as any other man of his day or of any other day. And so I would recommend that book, too, if you're really interested in digging around and learning more about the truth that you were never taught in government-run schools. And even if you went to private school, your teachers were probably trained, for the most part, in government schools. And so homeschooling really is the only genuinely private schooling anymore, with maybe a few exceptions in the entire United States and a few other places in the world. Now, some of the facts about Lincoln on race that you may never have been taught in school anywhere is that in the state of Illinois, he became a politician in 1832 by running for the state legislature, and he supported the Illinois Black Code. The Illinois Black Codes made it almost impossible for a black man to live and work in the state of Illinois. And he supported those. He also supported the Illinois Constitution, which was amended in 1848 to prohibit the immigration of black people into the state. And he also was a manager of something called the Illinois Colonization Society. And the Illinois Colonization Society lobbied the government, the state government, to use tax dollars to deport the small number of free black people that lived in the state of Illinois. And so they prohibited black people from legally moving into the state, and they did whatever they can to deport or colonize, so to speak, the small number of free black people who lived there. And if they, the ones who remained were discriminated against and could not, they could not vote, certainly. And they could not even testify against white people in court, which invited the criminal abuse of black people. They couldn't go to court and confront the people who they were accusing of robbing them or beating them or criminalizing them in any way. And Abe Lincoln voted against black suffrage in Illinois. He voted against giving black people the vote. He was a lawyer, of course, practiced law for many years, and he's said to have litigated thousands of cases, everything from horse thievery to murder. And he never defended a runaway slave, but he did defend a slave owner named Robert Matson. And you can read about this in the Pulitzer Prize-winning author David Donald's book of Lincoln, his biography of Lincoln. You can read the whole story of Lincoln defending a slave owner who was trying to recover his runaway slave. When he was president, Congress had to force Abe Lincoln to use black troops. He did not want to use black troops in the U.S. Army, but he was forced into doing it by the Congress. And then after he was forced into doing it, he paid the black troops $7 a month, whereas the white troops were paid $13 a month. During the war, when the U.S. Army took over the state of Louisiana before the war was over, at the end of the war, Lincoln himself drafted a constitution for the state of Louisiana. He personally drafted a constitution for that state, which presumably he wanted to be a model of sorts for other states. And when he drafted this, it did not include black suffrage. He did not allow black people to vote in the state of Louisiana in his draft. And he not only was a member of the Illinois Colonization Society, but Lincoln was sort of obsessed with this idea of colonization of all the black people, free or slave, out of America. Whenever he did mention a couple of speeches, compensated emancipation, which is the way in which all the northern states ended slavery, and most of the rest of the world, the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the French, the Danes, the Dutch, they all ended slavery peacefully. And in that regard, I would highly recommend a book by Jim Powell called Greatest Emancipations, How the West Ended Slavery. It tells the story of how every other country on the planet in the 19th century ended slavery peacefully, except for the United States. Only in the United States was there a war associated with the ending of slavery. There was a slave rebellion in Haiti in 1798, but it was very tiny, of course, compared to the number of slaves that were in the United States. And it was a slave rebellion. It was not a massive civil war with, the latest estimate, by the way, of the deaths of the Civil War are as much as 800,000 or 850,000, actually. The number that historians accepted for about 100 years was 620,000 deaths, which is more than all the deaths of Americans in all other American wars combined. World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, add them all up. The deaths of American soldiers does not amount to 620,000. And the latest estimates are as high as 850,000. And you can just Google that. You can look it up on the web. Just type in latest estimate of American Civil War deaths, and you'll find some New York Times articles and other articles about that. And so nothing remotely like that happened anywhere else on Earth in the 19th century. And so Lincoln, during his presidency, did actually appoint a man to be the head of colonization. And they spent millions of dollars trying to colonize a small number of free blacks who might have been interested in doing this into Liberia in Africa. The man in charge of this program ended up being an embezzler and embezzled a lot of the money. and the money and the program didn't really go much of anywhere. But Lincoln stuck with it his entire life. Now, the standard story that the mainstream historians say, without any evidence whatsoever, any proof whatsoever, is that Lincoln supposedly had some sort of epiphany in 1863, and he had advocated deportation or colonization his entire adult life, and then, until 1863, and then he gave up on it. That's the standard story. But one of the other books that I mentioned in the chat before the class, Colonization After Emancipation by Philip Magnus, who teaches at American University, and Sebastian Page from Oxford University, they disproved this. They went to the National Archives in the U.S., in Washington, D.C., and in London, and in Britain, and they found correspondence. They found correspondence with Abe Lincoln's signature to the British government and also to other governments, to the Dutch and others, showing that to his dying day, just 3 or 4 days before his death, Lincoln was still planning and plotting how to deport all the freed slaves once slavery was ended. He was working with William Seward, his Secretary of State, on figuring out the details on how many ships they would need to do this. And so it was sort of a weird obsession with him. And Lincoln actually referred to black people as the Africans quite a bit. And throughout his speeches and in his conversations, as though they were sort of aliens from another planet, the Africans. He didn't call anybody else the Italians or the Scottish or anything like that. It was the Africans. And of course, he never publicly spoke about the issue of slavery until he was 45 years old. The whole country in the United States, people were screaming at each other. There were famous Supreme Court decisions. There were all this acrimony over what to do about slavery, and Abe Lincoln was tight-lipped until he found a way to make political hay by talking about slavery, by coming out in opposition to the extension of slavery into new territories. Never did he oppose Southern slavery in politics, prior to being elected president, only the extension of slavery. Now, why the extension of slavery? Well, you just have to read his own writings. And in one of his speeches, he said, "We want to reserve the territories for the free white labor." And so free white labor, or the male labor, were the only people who had the right to vote. And as people were moving into the new territories, which were to become states, it was imminent that the territories were to become states, and people were to be voting. There would be two senators, and there would be members of Congress, and the electoral college votes for these states. Lincoln decided to pander to the white racists and white supremacists of the North, which was just about everyone in the North. The abolition societies only ever claimed to have no more than 2% of the adult male population as members of the societies. And so he was pandering for votes by saying, one, we will keep black people, free or slaves, away from competing for your jobs. And two, we will keep black people away, period. When he said, we want to preserve the territories for free white labor. So there you have it. That was the reason Lincoln gave, and that was the reason why the Republican Party put that in its platform of 1860, along with a statement supporting Southern slavery. And here it is. This was the 1860 Republican Party platform. It says this, quote, "Resolved that the maintenance inviolate of the rights of the states, and especially the right of each state to order and control its own domestic institutions, slavery, according to its own judgment exclusively, is essential to that balance of power on which the perfection and endurance of our political fabric depend, and we, the Republicans, denounce the lawless invasion by armed force of the soil of any state or territory, no matter under what pretext, as among the gravest of crimes." And of course, the Republicans did invade with an armed force the soil of all the southern states not too long after that. But the Republican Party platform, which Lincoln endorsed to get elected, to get nominated and elected, very explicitly defended Southern slavery as an institution, but opposed the extension of slavery for racist reasons, and also for reasons having to do with the Three-Fifths Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which said that for purposes of determining how many members of Congress each state will have, every five slaves count as three people. So if slaves go into the new territories, it would have increased the congressional representation of the Democratic Party. Therefore, the Republican Party was opposed to it. And so, and of course, you can read Lincoln's speeches. I put his first inaugural address on the reading list for tonight. And you can read his own words on his own speech about race. And here's probably one of the most famous quotes from him. This was from the September 18th, 1858 Lincoln Douglas debate, where Abraham Lincoln said this: "I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors or of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior, and I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." End quote. That was not the head of the Ku Klux Klan. That was Abraham Lincoln saying that in the Lincoln Douglas debate. And then in another debate, he said this about emancipation: "What then? Free them all and keep them," meaning the ex-slaves, "among us as underlings? Is it quite certain that this betters their condition? What next? Free them and make them politically and socially our equals? My own feelings will not admit of this. And if mine would, we well know that those of the great mass of white people will not. Whether this feeling accords with justice and sound judgment is not the sole question, if indeed it is any part of it. A universal feeling, whether well or ill-founded, cannot be safely disregarded. We cannot then make them equals." And Lincoln believed in this and demonstrated his belief in this until his dying day, in this sort of white supremacist view of race relations. And so those are, and you don't have to lift up rocks and uncover some old manuscript that everyone was thought had been burned 150 years ago. This is all in the collected writings of Abraham Lincoln, which are all online. They're all online. And so there's no problem getting it online. And whenever Lincoln did use nice-sounding language about equality or about natural rights, all men are created equal, that sort of thing, it's important to pay close attention. He was a slick trial lawyer. And it's important to put close attention to the words that he used. And whenever he did talk about these things, it was always in the abstract. When he said things like, one man should not be able to vote another man into slavery. He was all in favor of allowing one man to vote another man into slavery as long as they stayed in the Union and kept paying federal taxes. That was always his position. When he orchestrated the secession of West Virginia to become the last slave state to enter the Union, he allowed one man to vote another man into slavery. Slavery existed in West Virginia. They were a part of the Union. They gave them two more Republican senators in the 1864 election. They gave him more electoral college votes in the 1864 election, and he did not oppose slavery there at all. And so in the abstract, yes, everybody agreed one man, we should get rid of slavery. Robert E. Lee wrote a letter to his daughter once. You can find this in his collected writings, said, calling slavery everywhere in his practice a moral and political evil. Everyone knew it was a moral and political evil and had to be gotten rid of And Americans were doing what other countries had done and were debating how to go about it at the time, and except for Lincoln, of course. He only talked about it for the first time when he was 45 years old. And so whenever he did talk about equal rights or natural rights for black people, he meant once they're deported out of America. As you heard in that last statement from Lincoln, from one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, he said that they could never live as equals. He didn't believe white and black races could ever live as equals. Therefore, to put this into context, when he talked about all men are created equal, not here, not in the United States, is what he was saying. That was always his position. They could be equal in Africa, Panama, South America, somewhere else, not here. That was always his position. And so if you look at Lincoln's first inaugural address, which I also put online as one of the readings, I call his first inaugural address the strongest defense of slavery ever made by an American politician, because it was made by the President of the United States in his first inaugural address. It wasn't just some senator from Mississippi or from South Carolina or someplace like that. It was the President. And in his first inaugural address, he gives an ironclad defense of slavery. He says this: "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists." Very plain. "I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so." Then he says, "Those who nominated and elected me did so with full knowledge that I had made this and many similar declarations and had never recanted them. And more than this, they placed in the platform for my acceptance and as a law to themselves the clear and emphatic resolution," which I already read, the resolution defending Southern slavery in the Republican Party platform of 1860. Also in his first inaugural address, Lincoln gave his strong support to the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution. And there was an 1850 Fugitive Slave Law also that he strongly supported. And what this did was it forced the Northerners to round up runaway slaves and return them to their slave owners. And so here's Lincoln in his first inaugural address saying, "I support slavery in the southern states, and I also support as strong as anyone can support the Fugitive Slave Clause to continue forcing Northerners to serve as sort of enslaved Northerners as bounty hunters to run down runaway slaves and return them to their owners." And then the real clincher is at the end, near the end of his first inaugural address, Lincoln endorses a constitutional amendment that would have explicitly enshrined slavery in the Constitution. Slavery was mentioned nowhere in the original Constitution. The Fugitive Slave Clause is in the Constitution, and so implicitly it endorsed slavery, but not explicitly. And so this amendment, which I also put online as one of the readings for tonight, was called the Corwin Amendment. It was named after a Pennsylvania congressman. And the amendment says this, and this amendment had passed the House of Representatives and the United States Senate just a couple of days before Lincoln was inaugurated as president. And it said this: "No amendment shall be made to the Constitution which will authorize or give to Congress the power to abolish or interfere within any state the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons held to labor or service by the laws of said state." And so, "No amendment shall be made to the Constitution." Now, this says the Constitution can never be amended in a way that would allow Congress, that would authorize Congress the power to emancipate slaves. And in his first inaugural address, Lincoln endorsed this, the Corwin Amendment. He says this, we use his words from the first inaugural address: "I understand that a proposed amendment to the Constitution has passed Congress to the effect that the federal government shall never interfere with the domestic institutions of the states, including that of persons held to service, to To avoid misconstruction of what I have said, I depart from my purpose not to speak of particular amendments, so far as to say that holding such a provision to now be implied constitutional law, I have no objection to its being made express and irrevocable. So he says he thinks Southern slavery is already constitutional. It's already constitutional law. But I have no objection to its being made express and irrevocable. That means right in the text of the United States Constitution. Now, even the members of what I call the Lincoln cult, they all know about this, and they all write about it. For example, in Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals, which the Spielberg movie is based on, in part anyway, she writes about this. And that, in fact, she writes, using primary sources, she shows that the Corwin Amendment did not come from Congressman Corwin. It came from Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln used Seward as his emissary to the United States Senate, and he instructed William Seward to get through the United States Senate the Corwin Amendment. And this was Lincoln's amendment to enshrine slavery in the United States Constitution. Seward did get it through the United States Senate. He also instructed William Seward, this was after he was elected, but before he was inaugurated as president, he was working with Seward to get a second thing passed, a federal law that would nullify the so-called the liberty laws that some of the northern states had passed, personal liberty laws that some of the northern states had passed, which announced that they were not going to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. And so, and Seward did get that passed. And so the Corwin Amendment passed the House of Representatives and the Senate, and of course, to get a constitutional amendment passed in the United States requires, that's the first step, the House and the Senate vote on it. The President does not have a vote on it. He can voice his support or lack of support, but he has nothing to do with it, really, other than rhetoric, which Lincoln did support. But then has to get three-fourths of the states to become part of the Constitution. And a number of states had endorsed it, had voted in favor of it, but then the war came, and that was that. It disrupted the whole thing. And so to get a real, an accurate picture of the real Lincoln on the issue of race and slavery, you have to understand this. You have to understand where he was coming from. And, of course, I also put on the reading list the whole question of the cause of the war, the purpose of the war. Why was there a war? Okay. Well, Abe Lincoln said it in his first inaugural address again. So he bends over backward to remind everyone in the world, that he has no intention to disturb Southern slavery. His party's platform defends Southern slavery. He says he would not have been nominated and elected had he not full-heartedly endorsed that endorsement of Southern slavery. So that's why I call it the strongest defense of slavery ever made by an American politician. But on tax collection, Abe Lincoln was uncompromising. There will be war. To put this into context, let me put it into a long-term context. If you reverse back 30 years earlier, 1828, the Nationalists in American politics finally succeeded in getting a high protectionist tariff. It was called the Tariff of Abominations. It raised the average tariff rate on imports. The tariffs are basically a sales tax on imported goods from abroad to about 45% on average. And some items like woolen blankets had something like 200% tariffs on them. And so Southerners, especially South Carolinians, thought they were being discriminated against by the tax system of the federal government, because almost all of the tariffs were on manufactured goods, and the South was an agrarian society. And so clothing, shoes, farm tools were all being taxed, and the money was being imposed on people, everybody who bought these things, North and South. And then also they were complaining that most of the money was being spent in the North, too. And also this was, the purpose of this was protection from competition for almost exclusively northern business people. And so the state of South Carolina passed a law saying essentially we will not collect this new high tariff. And there was almost a war over this in 1828. They nullified the Tariff of Abominations. Lincoln comes along, and he knows this. He, of course, understands this. And so once again, 2 days before Lincoln is inaugurated, the House of Representatives and the Senate had passed the Morrill Tariff. This is spelled M-O-R-R-I-L-L, named after Justin Morrill, a politician from the state of Vermont, who was also a steel manufacturer. And this raised the average tariff rate from 15%, 1-5, to about 32.7%, more than double. Now, at the time, tariffs accounted for about 90% of all federal tax revenue. And so federal taxation, for all practical purposes, was tariffs. Federal taxes were more than doubled 2 days before Lincoln was inaugurated. And so Lincoln, in his first inaugural address, essentially says, we're not going to let you get away with nullifying this new doubling of the federal tax rate like South Carolinians did 33 years ago, to be more precise. We're not going to let you get away with this. Here's what he said. He literally threatens bloodshed or violence in his first inaugural address. He says this, there needs to be no bloodshed or violence, and there shall be none unless it is forced upon the national authority. Okay, this is on about page 4 of his first inaugural address. What could possibly force the national authority to impose violence and bloodshed on fellow citizens, on American citizens? Well, he says what it is in the next sentence. The next sentence, he says, the power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government. And here's the important part, to collect the duties and imposts. But beyond what may be necessary for these objects, there will be no invasion, no using of force against or among the people anywhere. So that's why there was a war. The southern states refused to pay taxes to the federal government in Washington, D.C. after they seceded. So the reasons the southern states gave for secession are irrelevant to the question of why there was a war. There was a war because Lincoln invaded to collect taxes as he promised. Secession per se does not necessitate war. The Soviet republics all peacefully seceded. There was no war. Norway and Sweden split through an act of peaceful secession. There was no war. So secession itself does not necessitate war. So the question of why there was a war is a totally different question of why the southern states seceded. My position is that every state always had a right to secede because the union was voluntary. And a voluntary union is a voluntary union. I mean, just like a voluntary marriage. You have a right to be married or to quit being married through divorce. You have a right to join any club or not join any club. You have a right to join a union or not join a union, at least in right-to-work states in America, so-called. And the same thing with the American Union. If the founding fathers of America agreed with Lincoln, or if they understood that the nationalists at the Constitutional Convention, what they meant by the American Union, it would have been governed by the Constitution, would be that if any state in the future were to withdraw from the Union for whatever reason, that the federal government then had the right to wage an army and invade that state, murder its citizens by the tens or hundreds of thousands, burn its cities to the ground, there would never have been a constitution. No one would have voted for such a constitution. Yet that is what Abe Lincoln's theory of the origin of the Constitution was, that the federal government was all-powerful, that the Union was never voluntary, and so forth. And therefore, the government has a right to mass murder dissenters to the Union. And of course, we'll talk about this much more throughout the course. And of course, the ugly fact of mass murdering as many as 450,000 fellow citizens has to be masked by something. You can't say it was about money and power, which it was. You have to say it was about freeing the slaves and saving the Union and other glorious things like that. Even though, as I said, all the other countries of the world freed the slaves peacefully, and in America could have also. One of the books I recommended on the chat before the lecture started was by William Marvel. William Marvel is a mainstream historian. He's a winner of the Lincoln Prize for writing books on Lincoln. So he's a very prominent member of what I call the Lincoln cult. But in this book, he's a straight shooter. He's a serious historian interested in pursuing the truth, which is why I like him. He's recommended also by Professor Clyde Wilson. And he says in the book that Lincoln could have ended slavery like the other, or Lincoln or anybody, other presidents, could have ended slavery peacefully through some kind of compensated emancipation, just like all the other countries of the world did. That's why I put on the reading list also the article by Jim Powell, who at the end of his article, he talks a little bit about his book, Greatest Emancipation, and he describes some of the ways in which some of the other countries in the world ended slavery peacefully, especially the British Empire, the story of how the British Empire essentially purchased the slaves and then legally ended slavery. And by purchasing the slaves, they ended the opposition by the slave owners. That's another book I would recommend, Powell's book, Greatest Emancipation. Now, maybe the final thing I'll mention here is about Lincoln's role in the 13th Amendment that finally did end slavery, which is the theme of the Steven Spielberg movie, Lincoln. And I put one of my articles on there that shows that the story of the movie is not at all truthful. If there is an authority in terms of Lincoln biographers alive today, it is David Donald, a retired historian from Harvard University, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, David Donald. His book on Lincoln. There's a good discussion there of Lincoln's role. What, if anything, did he do in getting the 13th Amendment passed? The 13th Amendment is the amendment to the United States Constitution that finally ended slavery and came into existence in 1866. The story of the movie is about how Lincoln used all of his political conniving, lying, and manipulating skills to get reluctant members of Congress to vote for this amendment. Now, it is true Lincoln was a master politician, and as Murray Rothbard once said, well, that a master politician is someone who is a masterful liar, conniver, and manipulator. That's true. Lincoln was that. But as David Donald recounts, Lincoln had almost nothing whatsoever to do with getting the 13th Amendment passed through Congress. He tells the story in the book of how some of the real abolitionists, people like Thaddeus Stevens and Wendell Phillips, went to Lincoln and tried to get his help to get some Democrats from New Jersey to vote for the 13th Amendment. And what they wanted to hold out as a debate was this. There was a government regulatory regime that regulated the railroad industry in the state of New Jersey. The abolitionists went to Lincoln and said, can't you do something to help us get rid of these regulations that are bothering these Democrats from New Jersey because they're harming the railroad industry companies in New Jersey. And in return for getting rid of this government regulation, we think we can get them to vote for the 13th Amendment. Lincoln refused. He said no. So when he was asked by the real abolitionists, the genuine abolitionists, to do something about this, to do something about the 13th Amendment finally formally ending slavery constitutionally, he refused. That's exactly the opposite of the story of the Spielberg movie. But contrast that with the first 13th Amendment. The Corwin Amendment was the first attempt to have a 13th Amendment. And as I just stated, that was Lincoln's amendment. He tried to do everything to get the first 13th Amendment passed that would have enshrined slavery in the Constitution. So the real story about Lincoln and the 13th Amendment is that he did everything possible in his power to get this amendment through Congress and through the states that would have enshrined slavery in the Constitution forever, and he did almost nothing 4 years later, 5 years later, to get the real 13th Amendment passed through Congress. So the Spielberg movie is based on a big lie. It said, all you have to do is don't read my book, read David Donald's book on Lincoln, who tells the truth about the 13th Amendment. And you can also read about this in Lerone Bennett Jr.'s book, Forced into Glory, Abraham Lincoln's White Dream. He also sort of smokes out this this big lie about this part of the myth of Lincoln and the 13th Amendment. And I guess one final thing I'll mention is the Emancipation Proclamation, which of course freed nobody because it only applied to rebel territory. It specifically exempted all the areas in the United States where the Union Army was in control at the time. All the parishes of Louisiana where the Union Army was in control were specifically mentioned as being exempt. The whole state of West Virginia was exempted because it was part of the Union. So it specifically said the only slaves that we hereby declare to be free are in states where we the U.S. government, have no power whatsoever to free them. That's why when I visited the Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, Illinois, a few years ago, and they had a very high-class video presentation there, and it's a very well-funded museum, and they had the face of an ex-slave on the screen, and a voiceover, and the voiceover had this slave, ex-slave's words, mocking and laughing about the Emancipation Proclamation, because this is a man who knew how to read. He was taught to read, and despite the fact that there were laws prohibiting it in most of the southern states. And he read that there was this Emancipation Proclamation, but he was still a slave. He was still a slave until 1866, and so he didn't believe it. And the whole world sort of mocked Lincoln over this. William Lloyd Garrison, the well-known abolitionist from Massachusetts, when he read the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, he condemned Lincoln in a speech saying that he did not have one drop of anti-slavery blood in his veins. And other British newspapers and other people around the world also condemned Lincoln for doing this because they thought it was just a feeble attempt to try to stir up slave rebellions in the southern states when most of the men were off at war. And it did not do that, but that's what a lot of people at the time thought was the purpose of the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, at the same time, a couple of Lincoln's generals, at the beginning of the war, took it upon themselves to issue decrees freeing slaves in the areas where they were. There was one in Georgia, for example, another one in Missouri, General Fremont in Missouri. And so they thought that this would cause a big disruption of the area. Some of the soldiers of the Confederate Army would have to leave the army and go back home. And so they issued their own emancipation decrees. Lincoln immediately rebuffed them, canceled the decrees, and fired the generals, stripped them of their commands for Hunter and Fremont, the two generals who did this in the first months of the war. And so not only did he not free anybody with his Emancipation Proclamation, and not that he had the constitutional authority to do so anyway, as he said in his first inaugural address, but when he had military officers who tried to do it in a small way, he did not do it at all. And so these are some of the facts that no one in America has ever taught in school about Lincoln, race, and slavery. And these are all things that I've cited in my books and my writings. They all come from university press books and scholarly articles, but you have to do a lot of digging. They do not come from the textbooks. The textbooks whitewash the real history, especially the most modern, most recent ones. And so, but history is history, and you can find it out there. And so I guess that's all I'm going to say for now. And this is the format that we usually use as a lecture of about this length. And then I just open it up. I'll be glad to answer questions for a while, the best that I can anyway. I can't necessarily answer every single question that you have, but feel free to pose questions. If you don't, we'll call it a night, but students usually do. I'll see if there's any questions on the chat. Let's see, we have a lot of chat. I'll see if there's any Q&A. Let's see, one question from Malcolm about wounded and Civil War deaths. Well, for many years, the multiple has been about 1.5. When they were saying that the deaths were 620,000, they would say that there was about a million wounded or maimed. So about 1.5 times. But now the upper limit on the estimate of deaths is 850,000. And so if you use that same multiple, that means more than 1.5 million maimed. And back in the Civil War days, they used 52 caliber rounds in their muskets. And so when you were hit with one of those rounds, your arm would be blown off. And so the wounds were horrific. I think there's one statistic that in 1 year after the war, the state of Mississippi spent 80% of the entire state budget on artificial limbs. Let's see if there's some more. Adam says his college teacher would turn pale as a ghost hearing this. Well, that's good. It's good to make the right people turn pale. Now, Lincoln did not sign the 13th Amendment. I mean, the president's signature is meaningless. The Constitution doesn't call for the president to sign any amendment. Somebody's asked, William was asking about this. It's really irrelevant whether he signed anything or not, because it's not necessary. I have read Bill O'Reilly's book, and his book really says nothing at all about Lincoln. It's a narrative of the last several days before Lincoln's assassination, and it sort of plagiarizes other works. There have been literally hundreds of other books written about the assassination, and there's not a single footnote in Bill O'Reilly's book. And they say, well, we've made use of everybody else's work, but they don't cite anybody else. Not one footnote in the entire book, not one reference listed anywhere. And so it's just a rehash of what everyone else has already written about. And it says nothing whatsoever about Lincoln's economic policies, about his war policies, about his trashing of the Constitution or his legacy in terms of economics and politics. It says nothing about nationalism versus states' rights, nothing at all. It's just a very, very boring narrative, step by step. He did this, he did that, he went here, he went there, and then he got shot by John Wilkes Booth. And it does have the usual silliness, though, that runs through almost all of the literature of what I call the Lincoln cult, is there's constant repetition of statements that say what was going through his mind at this point was, as though Bill O'Reilly and his co-author knew what was going through the mind of a man who died over 145 years ago. And I've seen this in many of the other books by Harry Jaffa and other people. You know, what he was thinking at this point, I also notice a lot of the rhetoric is what was in his heart was, as though it's possible to know what was in a man's heart who died 145 years ago. And so that's Bill O'Reilly's book. You won't learn anything about Lincoln if you read it. It's a very boring minute-by-minute narrative of the days leading up to the assassination. The book by William Marvel is written down. Mr. Lincoln Goes to War is the title of the book by William Marvel. Who's asking? Somebody's asking. Yeah, Carol was asking. So yeah, there's a question by Malcolm. Of course, Lincoln at his party, Quest did not want the South to secede because they would have taken with them a big chunk of tax dollars. They had grandiose plans to build a transcontinental railroad and to establish a continental empire as the first step of creating an empire that would rival the British Empire, an international empire, then on to China, on to Canada. They tried to conquer Canada during the War of 1812 and failed. There's still a lot of people who had high hopes of that. And all that, if the Southern states seceded and took with them all the tariff money that would have been collected at Charleston Harbor and New Orleans and other ports in the South. And in my book, Lincoln Unmasked, I even quote some congressman from Ohio named Giddings as saying, I can paraphrase, well, what will happen to our internal improvement subsidies and our tariff? And another thing that was important to them in the tariff is that they recognized all throughout the North that if the South seceded, the Confederate Constitution outlawed protection tariffs altogether. If they had free trade in the South and 50% average tariffs in the North, then much of the trade of the world would go to Charleston and New Orleans and not New York and Boston. And then Europeans would ship their goods into New Orleans, if not tariff-free, a modest 10% or so tariff. And then they could ship the goods up the Mississippi and through other vehicles to be sold in the United States. And so before the war started, in the real Lincoln, I quote, all sorts of newspapers from northern states associated with the Republican Party calling for the bombardment of southern ports by the U.S. Navy because they understood that to have a protectionist tariff, you could not allow anyone to escape that tax. You could not allow one state to have a lower tax than the other state. And so that's why they wanted a centralized monopoly government to enforce laws like the tariff tax. And secession would have destroyed that. Adam, I guess that's how he pronounces it, wants to know about the influence that Henry Clay played on Lincoln's views. He was the most influential person of all. Lincoln once called him the no ideal of the statesman, and Lincoln once said that all of his political ideas come from Henry Clay. He idolized Henry Clay. He called him the beau ideal statesman in a eulogy that he delivered for Henry Clay from Springfield, Ohio, when Henry Clay died in 1852. And when Abe Lincoln first got into politics, he made a speech where he said, I guess I can quote him. He said this, he said, I presume you all know who I am. I am humble Abraham Lincoln. This is in 1832. I have been solicited by many friends to become a candidate for the legislature. My politics are short and sweet like the old woman's dance. I am in favor of a national bank, in favor of the internal improvement system, and a high protective tariff. That was Henry Clay's American system. Henry Clay called that the American system. And so Lincoln, his whole career was lavishly devoted to these things: high protective tariff, corporate welfare, and a central bank modeled after the Bank of England. And that was the American system of Henry Clay. So he was a Hamiltonian and a devotee of Henry Clay. And I'm looking for one more quote about Clay's system. So I had to find it here real quick. There's another quote. This is from one of the books I mentioned at the beginning of the class, Lincoln the Man by Edgar Lee Masters. He's talking about Henry Clay here. About Lincoln. He said, Henry Clay was the champion of that political system which doles favors to the strong in order to win and to keep their adherence to the government. His system offered shelter to devious schemes and corrupt enterprises. He was the beloved son of Alexander Hamilton with his corrupt funding schemes is superstition concerning the advantage of a public debt and a people taxed to make profits for enterprises that cannot stand alone. His example and his doctrines led to the creation of a party that had no platform to announce because its principles were plunder and nothing else. So if your principles were plunder, you don't announce your platform. And that's what Lincoln said he got, where he got all of his political ideas from. He was a Whig for 25 years before he became a Republican, after all. And so he was the Whig Party, or the Northern Whig Party, was a party of the Northern moneyed elite. And Lincoln was a wealthy railroad lawyer. He represented all the major railroads of the Midwest, including the Continental Illinois, which was one of the biggest corporations in the world at the time. He lived in the biggest house in what today is called Old Aristocracy Road in Springfield, Illinois. He had house servants in his house. He was politically connected. After all, he got nominated to run for president by the Republican Party. The Republican Party never nominated anybody who was not a wealthy, politically connected business lobbyist, business type, as their presidential candidates. And so that's who Lincoln was. He was a Henry Clay man through and through. Question by Travis, the socialists say that war is an element of capitalism. No, war is the opposite of capitalism. Capitalism is the peaceful exchange, peaceful, mutually advantageous exchange that takes advantage of the international division of labor. War is the opposite of that. War is the destruction of peaceful exchange. War is killing people, not trading with people. What is imposed on other countries at gunpoint from time to time is mercantilism, is a system of government-enforced contracts, government-enforced spending programs that benefit politically corrected businesses. That's what military interventionism leads to, is mercantilism at home and abroad, not capitalism. If you want to read something very eloquent about this, read the chapter in Human Action on War and the Economy by Ludwig von Mises. And war was that, all the socialists in America were in favor of World War I because they thought it would be a model of socialist central planning in peacetime. They thought a planned economy during wartime could be used to make the argument that we won the war, we used socialistic central planning to win the war, therefore we should adopt socialist central planning in peacetime after the war. That was the mantra of the progressives in America in the early 20th century. Let's see. Larry Simons has asked, well, why was an amendment needed if the Emancipation Proclamation ended slavery? It didn't end slavery. In fact, Lincoln called it a war measure, which meant that if the war ended a week later, it would have had no effect whatsoever on anybody. So his position was always, you can keep your slaves as long as you stay in the Union and keep paying federal taxes. Read Lincoln's letter to Horace Greeley, which I put on the syllabus for tonight online. Horace Greeley wrote it. The famous newspaper man asked him, what do you intend to do about the slaves? And Lincoln says, my purpose in the war is to save the Union. And if I could do that by leaving all the slaves in slavery, I would do that. If I could do it by freeing some and leaving others in bondage, I would also do that. Whatever I do about slavery, it has to do with the ultimate goal of saving the Union. And of course, I have argued in all my writings that the war destroyed the Union. The original Union was a voluntary Union. It created a Union that was more like the Soviet Union, held together at gunpoint and with violence, not a voluntary Union at all. So that rhetoric is also false. Uh, Malcolm is asking about the Chamber of Commerce and the Whig Party. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know the history of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But the Whig Party, the Northern branch especially, was a party of Northern big business interests. There were Southern Whigs also, but as they say, politics makes for strange bedfellows. But every member of Lincoln's cabinet was a former Whig. The Whig Party disbanded because they failed to produce for their benefactors high protectionist tariffs, massive corporate welfare, and a central bank. Lincoln succeeded. The Republican Party was the reincarnation of the Whigs that brought some other people into the party to try to, but this was always the agenda. This was always the economic agenda of the Whigs, these things. And so they finally did. We're going to talk about that next week, how they finally did achieve the Whig agenda during the Lincoln administration, with all the subsidies to the railroads. The average tariff rate went to the 50% range for 50 years after the Civil War, and the money supply was nationalized with the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts. See, what else we have here? There's a question from Malcolm again on Northern tariffs destroying the South post-Civil War. Well, the high tariff rate that existed, high tariffs always imposed disproportionate harm on farmers in the United States, because what happens is, for an agricultural society like the South, they even at the time the war broke out, they were exporting about 3/4 of everything to Europe. And so when you have protectionist tariffs, you impoverish your trading partners. Europeans cannot sell as much in the United States, and therefore they don't acquire as many dollars which can be used to buy American goods, and the American goods are mostly farm goods. And so it's a double whammy to farmers. One, they pay higher prices for clothing and farm tools and shoes and blankets and things like that. And two, much of their business in Europe dries up in terms of selling less. And so after the war, the Midwestern farmers from the upper Midwest sort of teamed up with Southern farmers to oppose tariffs, high tariffs. And unfortunately, they were used politically, literally used tools to get an income tax passed eventually in 1913 with the promise of lower tax rates. That was the bait, lower tax rates. And then after the income tax came in 1913, the tariff rate was jacked back up. So we ended up, by 1929, we ended up with 60% average tariffs and an income tax. And so, they were plundered through tariffs after the war as much as any farmers were. Cam is doing a great job as usual. Larry is asking a question again about the Corwin Amendment and seceding. Well, but the big issue at the time was the extension of slavery into the territories, as I've said, and I quoted from Lincoln himself. And so that was the big issue. Now, when the Southern states seceded, they gave up any claim to bringing slaves into the territory. That always was a red herring. These northern territories were not amenable to slave labor any more than Massachusetts was. They had short growing seasons, bad soil in a lot of these places. There was no real movement to bring slaves into these places, just a few. But the New Englanders, who were largely the majority of the settlers in these places, were scared to death that black people would be living among them. And so they're the ones who pressured the Republican Party to adopt black codes. And many other states and territories followed Illinois in making it illegal for black people to move into these places. to begin with. And of course, Lincoln didn't get any support from the South. Let's see, what else do we have here? Yeah, I guess we might be running out of gas a little bit. I'll look for any more questions. Okay. Well, Dan wants to know how the tide can be turned. Well, we can only hope that we can spread enough truth. What keeps Ron Paul going? He understands this. He understands that we're greatly outnumbered. Go online, go to Mises.org, look for a speech by Gary North on the remnant. I can't remember the name of the speech, unfortunately. It was a speech he gave at Mises University, I think, last year or the year before. And he's referring to the Bible. He's referring to how there was a remnant of believers who went around and kept the biblical teachings alive. And he talks about the remnant being people like the Mises Institute, the remnants who still talk about classical liberal ideas and keeping them alive, keeping the books alive, and pursuing the truth about statism, among other things. And the remnant often succeeds. You don't have to convince everybody. Pat Buchanan is sort of weird. He's sort of an economic ignoramus when it comes to economics. I like Pat Buchanan and a lot of other things. John Seiler is asking about him. No, American prosperity came despite Hamilton's system. Hamilton's system is exactly the system we have right now today. A hyperactive central bank, big public debt, corporate welfare run amok. That's the Hamilton system. It's Hamiltonianism personified. That's the system we've got. And that's why we're bankrupted, inflationary, crony capitalism. Hamilton was a champion of crony capitalism. And so, Pat Buchanan says this. I know he does. But unfortunately, Pat seems to be uneducable when it comes to economics. And he just is. Well, it looks like we've about run out of gas. And so maybe we'll end it about here. I see we're sort of out of questions. Thank you all for participating. I hope you learned a good bit from the class, and we'll continue on in this way, and I'll be glad to answer these questions that you have. And my objective is to expose you to as much learning as you can, and I don't care if you become a Lincoln hater like me or not, but facts are facts, and I try to use what I know about economics and Austrian social theory to interpret these facts. So have a good night.